Bonjour, bonjour à tous et merci de venir à cette conférence qui va être entièrement consacrée à Nancy Kress. Une jolie rencontre avec cet auteur. Avant de commencer, pour ceux qui ne comprendraient pas l'anglais, il y a des petits boîtiers à retirer juste derrière le jeune homme au pull marin est en train de lever la main pour que vous puissiez suivre les propos de Nancy Kress. Juste pour présenter, plus simplement, on va pouvoir regarder un petit peu toute votre carrière et passer un petit peu sur vos romans. Simplement, vous trouverez assez facilement en France des œuvres comme Danse aérienne, Le cycle de la probabilité qui est paru chez Pocket, Les hommes dénaturés, ou bien encore Lune rêve l'autre pas qui vient d'être réédité aux éditions ActuSF. Et à noter aussi que Nancy Kress a une nouvelle dans l'anthologie officielle des Utopiales. Donc voilà pour les principaux titres de Nancy Kress. On est très très content parce qu'une auteure de science-fiction de cette qualité et qui marie science et puis un côté un peu très humain et très social des choses, c'est rare et on est vraiment très heureux de l'avoir. Petite question sur une petite question sur vos débuts. Est-ce que vous étiez une grosse lectrice de science-fiction? Qu'est-ce qui vous a amené à la science-fiction et à l'écriture?
I came to reading it later than most American children. And the reason for this is that when I was growing up in the 1950s, I don't know how it was in France, but in the United States there was very much a different culture for boys and girls. And in the local library, all of the science fiction was put in the boys' section. And all of the fairy tales, the contes de fées, were put in the girls' section. And so I never read any science fiction when I was a child. And I didn't discover it until I was 14. And I had my first boyfriend who was studying to be a pianist. And every day after school, he would practice the piano. And I would go over to his house, and I would, being a teenage girl, hang adoringly over the piano while he practiced. Well, I have no musical ability at all. I'm tone deaf. So I would only hang adoringly for about 10 minutes. And then I would start pulling books off the shelf in his father's library. And one of the books I pulled off to look at was Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End. And I was in love. And not with the pianist. Suddenly, I saw a fiction that was large enough, that had a canvas as large as the whole galaxy, and I was just enthralled. But I still read it, I read a lot of it, but I didn't expect to write it. I was raised in a very small town by a very conservative Italian-American mother who had strict ideas and limited ideas of what was suitable for girls. And when I was 12, she said to me, "Do you want to be a teacher, a nurse, or a secretary?" Those were the only things that she could think were possible for girls. And I thought about it, and I said, "Okay, I will teach small children." And I did. I became a teacher of small children in a primary school until I married for the first time. And it never occurred to me that I could write. But then, and I know of no male writers for whom this is their history, then when I was pregnant with my second child, and I had a toddler, a small child at home, and we lived way out in the country, and I had no car, and there were no other women at home during the day, and my husband was taking the car to work and then to classes because he was taking an advanced degree. I was alone with this child and a very difficult pregnancy. And I started writing just to have something to do with words of two syllables. And I did not take it seriously for a very long time. I sent out stories, they came back. I sent them out again, they came back again. And it did not occur to me that this would ever be a career. I fell into it by accident. And that's not true of most writers. The only thing part that is true of most writers is that I always read everything with a total lack of discrimination and a total lack of taste. I read bad fiction, I read good fiction, I read classics, I read trash, I read the back of cereal boxes, I read anything that was available. And that is true of every writer I've ever known.
Est-ce que ses premiers écrits, c'était déjà de la science-fiction et de l'imaginaire, ou à ce moment-là, vous écriviez un petit peu de tout ?
No, they were always science-fiction, and I don't know why. I had read a lot of science-fiction, but I had read a lot of everything. And my favorite writer is the British classic novelist Jane Austen, who is certainly very far from science-fiction. But it came out science-fiction. And again, this is something over which I have had very little control. I know writers who seem to have a firm control of their creative process. They say, oh, I have 10, 20, 50 ideas, and I pick out the one that I think will be the most successful, and I shape it in a way that I think will be successful. I can't do that. I always feel lucky to have one idea. And it kind of shapes itself in my mind. And I don't feel that I have the level of control. So when it came out, those early stories came out science fiction, and always have, science fiction is what I wrote.
Votre première nouvelle, c'est 1976, dans le magazine Galaxy. Alors vous en parlez un petit peu sur votre site. De quoi parlait-elle et puis comment ça s'est fait ? Quel a été le passage ? Mais je vous pose aussi la question, parce que sur votre site, il y a beaucoup de conseils aux jeunes écrivains. Donc racontez-nous, vous, votre première fois, comment ça s'est fait ?
The first story I published, first of all, it only got published because I was so naive. Galaxy at that time was a science fiction magazine going into bankruptcy. It was going to have to stop because it had no money. Most established writers knew this. I did not know this. I knew nobody in the publishing community, and I didn't know that they had stopped paying their writers. So I sent them my story, and they were glad to get one, and they published my story and promptly went out of business. It took me 3 years to get my tiny little payment. I kept writing letters saying, this was my first story, I really want to be paid for it. And eventually they did. Eventually they did give me my $105, and that was a very important thing for me. The topic of the story is revealing in one way, because what has interested me always in science fiction is the characters. And that very first story is about a grandmother whose daughter, daughter's husband, and grandchildren are leaving Earth forever on a colony ship. She will never see them again. And I wanted to write about the emotions of the people left behind by these kind of technologies. And so it's the story of her trying to get a handle, get control of herself, that she will never see these people she loves intensely again, because they are going to the stars, and she is not. And it has continued to be true of me that the characters are the most important thing for me, and that is where my writing goes.
Une petite question sur cette période où vous étiez une jeune écrivaine. C'est vrai que vous donnez beaucoup de conseils. Hein, si vous avez l'occasion d'aller sur le site internet de Nancy Kress, il y a toute une partie conseils aux jeunes écrivains. C'est important pour vous de transmettre ?
Yes, but my website is not a good place to look because it's 3 years out of date. I am not good at keeping up my website. I need to hire a web designer who will do it properly, because I have not. But I do give a lot of advice because I teach writing. I teach writing at different places. I was one semester at the University of Leipzig in Germany. I teach at writing festivals in the summer throughout the United States. And I teach a lot of young writers who want to write science fiction professionally. So I do transmit a lot of advice. And sometimes they actually listen to it. Not always.
Parlons un petit peu de votre premier roman. Alors, on a beaucoup parlé de science-fiction, mais là, en fait, ce premier roman, c'est un roman de fantasy. C'est Le Prince de l'Aube en 1981. Alors, comment est-ce que vous êtes passé des nouvelles au roman, et pourquoi la fantasy, alors qu'a priori, jusqu'ici, c'était plutôt la science-fiction?
I don't know. The first three novels were fantasy, and I don't know why they were fantasy. Then I switched to science fiction, and the next 20 novels have been science fiction. And I don't know why that is true either. I write what seizes my imagination at the time that I am starting the book. I have to get passionately involved with the characters or I can't write it. And so those were the characters I got passionately involved with. I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but again, I don't have the control over my work that many writers seem to have.
Il y a beaucoup de personnages féminins hein, dans ces deux romans. Alors, est-ce que c'est une raison d'identification pour une jeune romancière ?
It's easier for me to write women because obviously I understand them better, being one. I have done male main characters and I try hard to make them as real as possible. But you guys think differently than we do. And it can be a little difficult sometimes to capture that. In the same fashion, I think there are many male writers who do better writing male protagonists than women. The previous roundtable on this stage was on Isaac Asimov, who never could write female characters at all. Even Dr. Susan Calvin is not convincing as a woman. She is essentially a man with breasts. And I do write young children characters a lot, and they will be sometimes boys, because again, it is easier for me to understand that. And I also write old people. I have won a few prizes in the United States. My most recent Hugo was for a novella called The Erdmann Nexus. And Henry Erdmann, the main character, is over 90 years old. I find it easier to write older people because, again, they make more sense to me. Maybe because I'm getting to be an older people.
Justement, on fait un petit arrêt sur... vous avez évoqué le prix Hugo, vous avez eu beaucoup de prix dans votre carrière. Est-ce que c'est important, en tant qu'écrivain, de pouvoir recevoir ce genre de distinction?
It was important when I was younger. It's exciting, and you like to know that your work has been acknowledged. But the more you see of the prize-giving machinery, and this is probably true of any prize, you see that it doesn't always go to the most worthy candidate. There are a whole many other things involved. How many people have read your story? How many people had dinner with you and liked you? How many people didn't see the story that was better than yours but didn't win because not so many people read it? How many people just liked the topic you were writing about and perhaps lacked the discrimination to see that it wasn't a very good story but they liked the topic? So many different things go into the awarding of prizes that I no longer take them as seriously as I used to. Still, they're fun.
En France, on vous a redécouvert à la fin des années 90 avec Danse aérienne, qui était une novella sur des danseuses qui étaient bio-améliorées. Donc c'est des danseuses qui sont améliorées pour évidemment pouvoir danser encore mieux, aller toujours plus loin avec leur corps. Comment est-ce que vous avez imaginé et quelle est l'idée de départ de cette grosse nouvelle, cette novella?
Well, I've always been interested in ballet. I had ballet lessons as a child, and they were a complete failure. My teacher told my mother, she lacks rhythm, coordination, musicality, stamina, flexibility, and she's too tall. So it was clear I was never going to be a dancer. But I've continued to be very interested in dance. And when I write a story like Dancing on Air, the problem is that most science fiction writers and most ballet lovers are not the same people. So I think there are about four people in the intersection between ballet lovers and science fiction readers. But I continue to write about dancers because it interests me a lot. And with the whole Lance Armstrong thing, we have seen the question of should dancers and athletes be allowed, in this case it's drugs, but it will eventually be biological, built-in biological improvements. Is this fair? Can we stop this? Is it reasonable to think we can stop this? Should we stop this? Can we not get better performance if we are allowed biological improvements. I don't know. We're already becoming, to some extent, cyborgs, which is a mixture of human and machine. I know people with pacemakers for their heart implanted. I know people with, many people with contact lenses for the eyes. If you already have some mechanical parts on you, and the next step is a biological part that is an improvement, do you think we can stop that? I don't think so. So when I wrote Dancing on Air, I was interested in the reaction of the dance world and the larger community to these questions for dancers. There's also the larger question of, can we ever know if a dancer has been biologically improved or not?
Et en même temps, dans ces rôles-là, vous êtes très critique avec ces améliorations. Vous avez presque une position un peu de défiance par rapport à cette technologie.
The characters challenge this technology. The author is not the characters. And some of the characters challenge the technology, some of it approve of it. And I hope that I manage to present both sides, because that is what I think good fiction does. It looks for the complexities and contradictions in a situation rather than take one simple side. I don't read much space opera because it seems to me too simple. There are good guys and there are bad guys. Life is almost never like that. So I try to create characters and situations and views of technology that look at both sides.
Je voudrais qu'on évoque un roman qui s'appelle Les Hommes Dénaturés. Dans Les Hommes Dénaturés, les couples qui n'arrivent pas à avoir d'enfants adoptent une espèce de substitut des singes. C'est vraiment un roman autour de la maternité. Je vais vous demander pareil un petit peu, comment est-ce que vous l'avez imaginé? Comment est-ce que est née l'idée des Hommes Dénaturés?
The origin of that idea was actually some real science. I had been reading in various scientific journals that the male sperm count around the world is falling. Right now, the male sperm count is about half of what it was in 1940. And it isn't that this is a problem yet, but one thing that science fiction asks is, and this does come from Asimov, if this goes on, if a trend continues, where will we be? There have been several reasons, possibilities put forth for the falling male sperm count, most of them environmental. But if this is the case, what if we get to the point where almost no one can have a child? What would the human race do at that point? And in my novel, it isn't where we are facing extinction. There are still enough children born that the human race will continue. But there are a lot of people who would like a child in my novel who cannot have one because of this problem. So they do adopt biologically engineered monkeys with more human faces. I found this sort of horrifying, but one of the points I wanted to make is that whatever a society becomes used to is normal. When you become accustomed to something, that is the new normal. And so these sort of chimp children become adopted. And in a way, this is not such a far stretch. Think of all the people you know who have dogs. I don't know how it is in France, but in America, dog lovers are really fanatic. They are really, really extreme people. And they treat their dogs like children. In many cases, they treat them better than they treat their children. So I think this might actually come to pass. If we had not enough children, we might very well look for some substitute to treat like children.
Vous avez sur la technologie, vous avez souvent des interrogations et surtout de l'impact de cette technologie, notamment sur les sociétés. Est-ce que ça veut dire que vous êtes pessimiste? Est-ce qu'on peut dire ça vis-à-vis de la technologie?
No, not at all. I'm not pessimistic vis-à-vis technology. But I write about its impact on society because it seems to me that that's what fiction is about. If I just write about the technology itself, then I might as well write essays. non-fiction essays. The whole point of science fiction is to take a scientific advance or a technological advance and to say, okay, if we do this, what might happen? And there are many different things that might happen as a result of any technology. And what the writer does is construct a thought experiment, saying, okay, if we have this, what would be the consequences? Or what would be one possible set of consequences? And then you explore that, trying to see its impact on people. This is science fiction's contribution to science. We are not, for the most part, scientists ourselves, although some writers are. But even those science fiction writers that are scientists are usually not doing cutting-edge science because they're writing fiction, and you only have so much time. So science fiction's contribution to science is to model what might be the possible impact of any science on the rest of us.
Un petit mot sur l'animalité, puisque on l'a dit, que ce soit dans Les Hommes dénaturés avec des singes qui sont adoptés comme des enfants, ou dans Danse aérienne où on a une espèce de chien qui fait office de garde du corps, un petit peu pour la danseuse, on ne va pas tout révéler, mais un chien qui peut parler, qui a un niveau de conscience un peu plus élevé que ce dont on a l'habitude. Quel est votre rapport par rapport justement à l'animalité que dans ces deux textes, vous rapprochez un tout petit peu de l'humanité?
Well, human beings are animals. I mean, we share a lot of our physiology with the animal world. Chimpanzees have 98% the same DNA that we do. And even a mouse has a very large sharing of the same DNA as human beings. And I think when you think about the future, you need to think about where the animals will fit in. And it comes naturally to me to do that. Oh. We are animals. We may be more than animals, but we are also animals.
On va s'intéresser un peu à L'une rêve, l'autre pas, Bigger in Spain. Pareil, alors on est là aussi dans un roman qui s'interroge, puisque c'est l'histoire de deux jumelles dont une va être modifiée pour ne pas dormir. Comment est née l'idée de ce roman, et est-ce que c'est la même dynamique d'interrogation? À partir de quel point vous êtes interrogé?
Beggars in Spain is about people genetically engineered to not need to sleep. And I wrote it out of jealousy. I need to sleep 8 or 9 hours every night, and I resent it because people who sleep, I have friends who sleep only 5-6 hours every night. They get more life than I do. They have more awake life. And I resent that. I really hate it. So I created these people who never have to sleep. And the way it happens is the child is created in vitro. The mother's egg and the father's sperm are mixed in a petri dish, and then they change some of the genes, and then it's implanted in the mother. But at the same time, unknown, and they did not plan on this in my book, another egg and sperm are naturally implanted at the same time, which is how you end up with twins anyway. So she's carrying twins, one genetically modified to not sleep and one who is a normal child. And the story is about two things. It's about the relationship between these sisters who are so different from each other. And in a larger sense, it's a relationship about how we react to people who are different. When I wrote this, I wanted to create a genetic modification that is not negative. Almost always in science fiction, whenever there is a human being who has been cloned or modified genetically, it ends up to be a monster, and it is a negative portrayal. I wanted to create a portrayal of a biological change with no bad side effects. And there are no bad side effects. Lysha, the girl, is smart, intelligent, beautiful, compassionate, and she doesn't need to sleep. The problem is, without a conflict, you don't have a story. So the conflict comes in then from how the rest of society reacts to these sleepless people. And as time goes on and the generations go on, humanity goes into two paths. You have some who sleep and some who don't. And the ones who do not sleep have an evolutionary advantage. And so what does that do? How do the rest of us feel if we are being left behind by evolution? Do we feel this is an unfair advantage that they have? So the conflict in the story comes in the social part, but it is actually optimistic about the technology.
C'est aussi un roman sur la différence.
Yes. How do we treat those people who are different from us? Especially if we think their difference makes them better.
C'est une novella, un court roman qui a eu un joli succès. Et il y a notamment eu, on a recensé au moins 5 prix, Hugo, un Nebula, etc. Quand on est écrivain et qu'on a l'habitude d'écrire des histoires, est-ce que vous sentiez déjà à l'écriture qu'il y avait cette potentialité pour avoir autant de prix et autant de succès? Est-ce que vous l'expliquez? Parce que ça n'arrive pas tous les jours.
What is exists in French is the shorter version. It was a novella in English. And then I turned it into a novel, which is much longer. And the novella is the first part of the novel. And it then extends it through 3 more generations, which tells the whole story. As for why it was successful, I don't know. I think that people identified with being someone different. Most science fiction readers that I know feel different from the mainstream of society. They do feel a little bit out of touch, out of sync with mainstream society. And maybe that appealed to readers. But I really don't know.
Je voudrais parler aussi d'un cycle qu'on a découvert en France qui s'appelle le cycle de la probabilité. Est-ce que c'est donc un gros cycle, hein? Chez nous, il y a 3 romans qui, pour le coup, nous emmènent véritablement dans les étoiles, hein? Donc on n'est pas tout à fait dans ce que vous avez l'habitude de faire dans Les Hommes Dénaturés ou dans Danse Aérienne. Comment est née l'idée de ce roman? Et puis on va parler de la rencontre avec les extraterrestres aussi.
No, it is much different. But it too grew out of a novella, a shorter story that I wrote called The Flowers of Allat Prison. And it was exploring an alien culture. And after I had finished the novella, I felt there was more story left to tell. My mic is making odd noises. Can you hear them?
Yeah.
Is it whistling? It's making whistles. Well, I will go in and... When I had finished the short story, I felt there was more that I wanted to say in the novel. And so I wrote the next novel, and then there was more, so I wrote the next novel, and then there was more, so I wrote the next novel, and I ended up with a trilogy, which was not what I had planned. And it is different because it is space opera. It is my one large-scale attempt to deal with future physics and not just with future biology. And I found it very, very difficult. I do not have training as a physicist. And what I was trying to do here, and please, all the physicists in the audience, please don't laugh. I invented a fifth force in the universe. We have 4 now. We have gravity, electromagnetism, the weak force, and the strong force. I invented a fifth one. And what this fifth one is probability. If you say, this atom has a 62% chance of decaying, and this atom has a 17% chance of decaying, those are probabilities. So I decided that itself should be a force, and I gave it its own messenger particle with mass and spin and all of the rest of the attributes that the other physical forces in the universe have. In order to do this, I had to do a lot of reading in physics and take a lot of notes. And it's the only time that I ended up with headaches from writing fiction, because it was not easy for me for my mind to work in these kinds of areas. On the other hand, I kind of enjoyed it because it was something brand new, and I got a chance to employ not only this new physics, invented physics, but also spaceships and a galaxy-wide canvas such as I had fallen in love with when I was reading Arthur Clarke all those decades ago.
Alors, parlons un petit peu donc de cette trilogie. Hein. C'est une alliance solaire. Hein. L'humanité a essaimé sur plusieurs planètes. Et ils vont découvrir un artefact extraterrestre qui va leur permettre justement de voyager encore plus loin et plus vite. Parlez-nous un petit peu de cette rencontre avec l'inconnu qu'est cet artefact. Qu'est-ce qui vous intéressait dans cette rencontre?
The artifact in the probability series is left over from another ancient alien civilization that we never see. They are long gone. But the artifact allows for the manipulation of the fabric of space-time itself. And one of the questions I wanted to look at was, should human beings be trusted with being able to manipulate space-time? Because what you're talking about is the possible destruction of the entire galaxy. And if we had that power, how would we react to it? And that's partly what I wanted to explore when I was writing the novels. And the answer is, we don't react very well.
Et je voulais parler des extraterrestres. Alors, pour un auteur de science-fiction, évidemment, l'extraterrestre, c'est toujours quelque chose d'important. Comment est-ce que vous les avez imaginés? Et puis, la rencontre entre les humains et les faucheurs se passe particulièrement mal. Et donc, pourquoi?
Humans have a built-in xenophobia, which means a fear of the alien or a fear of those that are different. We evolved 500,000 years ago or more in Africa to look at other tribes as dangers. And we still do, to some extent. Otherwise, there wouldn't be nations fighting each other all the time. And we evolved to compete for territory, to compete for resources. I think that humans are innately aggressive animals. And when we encounter those that are outside ourselves, not all of us and not all the time, but there will be an aggressive, xenophobic reaction. And I think when we encounter aliens, that may also happen. I know science fiction writers who have written books, many books, where aliens attack Earth. They want Earth. It's never really explained why aliens want Earth. If they have starfaring abilities, what do they want with us? And there are really no good answers. They want gold. There's lots of gold out there in the universe. They want slaves. They can build starships. They can build robots. All of the pulp fiction of the 1930s, they wanted our women, which is even a more ridiculous answer. But the very fact that science fiction has this xenophobic, look out, the aliens are coming and they're dangerous tendency confirms that I think we are not necessarily going to react well when we do see alien ships above us in the skies. And I think that's too bad. But I also think that because it's hardwired into our DNA, that's why it turns up in my novels. I'm not happy about it.
Quel regard vous portez sur cette trilogie qui est donc un petit peu à part dans votre bibliographie? Est-ce que vous recommenceriez une trilogie comme ça, de cette ampleur-là?
I don't know. I never know what I'm going to write. So maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I don't know.
Justement, parlons un petit peu de vos idées et comment naissent vos idées. Comment est-ce que vous travaillez en tant qu'écrivain? Est-ce que vous vous documentez beaucoup? On l'a vu, j'imagine que vous documentez beaucoup, notamment au niveau des sciences. Et donc, comment vous faites pour écrire?
The process for me is that I will read something in a scientific journal or in another book, and it will spark something in my mind. I will think, that's really interesting. And I'll keep the idea there until a character turns up. Because for me, the story always begins with a character. And when I see a character that I'm interested in, the first scene usually comes very easily. For instance, when I was writing Beggars in Spain, the idea of somebody, a baby, genetically engineered to not need to sleep was there in my mind a long time. And then when the character turns up of these two parents who deliberately create this child, I could see them. The father wants the baby, the mother does not. He's the powerful figure. He overrules her. And the first scene where they are sitting in the doctor's office explaining what they want came very, very easily. And this is true of nearly all my fiction. The first scene, the second scene, sometimes the third, they come easily. And then because I have not planned, I do not plan the endings, I don't see past that first scene, then I usually have to stop and start to think about it. And I think about the questions, what do these people want? And the other question, what can go wrong? Because fiction is about stuff that goes wrong. So I start thinking, what can go wrong with these scenes, with this situation? And then from there, the next scene will come, and maybe the next scene. But I don't know the end. I write like a man who is driving down a dark road at night. You know, when you are in your car and you drive down a dark road at night, you have your headlights on, and the headlights illuminate some road ahead. I can see that far, and I hope that by the time I have written myself that far, the headlights will have illuminated the next stretch of road, and on like that until the end. Sometimes this doesn't work. I get to half of the way or two-thirds of the way through a book, and no good end comes to me. And then I cannot finish the story. And this has happened. When you don't plot ahead of time, when you don't outline ahead of time, when you don't plan everything ahead of time, sometimes the story just dies. And I have had that happen. It's too bad. But this is the only way I can work. Because I like it the best when the characters surprise me. I'll be writing along, and a character will do something, and I will think, wow, I didn't think of that. I don't know where it came from, but it wasn't me. I didn't plan it. And then I get very excited about it, and I take the story in that direction. And for me, that is one of the most satisfying parts of writing, when the characters take over.
Est-ce que ça veut dire que pour vous, les personnages sont presque vivants, ils sont au-delà de personnages de fiction?
Very much. Very much alive. My characters, some of the most vivid people in my life don't actually exist. I have fallen in love with my heroes. I have gone around lovesick over men I have created on the page. I have wanted to rescue children I have created who don't exist. I've wanted to be women I have created as models. Yes, they're very, very real to me, very alive. Sometimes more than real people. I don't say that this is a good thing, but I do say that all writers are a little bit crazy. Oh.
Parlons un petit peu de votre dernier roman, Flashpoint, qui est un roman plutôt pour young adultes, pour les ados. De quoi parle-t-il, puisqu'on n'a pas encore eu l'occasion de le lire en France?
Well, neither has anybody else. It only came out yesterday, literally yesterday. So it will be out in the United States now, and I'm hoping that we sell the French rights. There's always a lag between when a book comes out and when we sell the foreign rights. It is a young adult novel, my first, and it's about a future reality show on television in the United States, which is on the verge of revolution. The economy has collapsed so much, and people are so out of work and so angry. Picture Greece only several times over, that we are on the edge of revolution. And my heroine is a young girl, 16, who is trying to find a job to support her dying grandmother and her very wild younger sister, whom nobody can control. And she takes a job. She doesn't even know what it is, but she will take any job as a contestant on this television show. And the television show puts the teenage contestants through various scenarios, some virtual, some real. They never know what is going to happen. And the producers of the television show are getting desperate for ratings, so they are pushing more and more dangerous scenarios. And she feels she must do these things because they so desperately need the money. And that's the setup, and it goes on from there. My hope is that it will appeal to young people. I hope.
On arrive doucement à la fin de cet entretien, hein, puisqu'il nous reste une dizaine de minutes, le temps de quelques questions. Est-ce que vous avez une question à poser à Nancy Kress? Oui.
Bonjour. Alors, si je ne m'abuse, Nancy Kress a été mariée pendant quelques années à Charles Sheffield, qui a été lui aussi un auteur de SF, très bon auteur en fait, de mon point de vue. Et ce que je voudrais savoir, c'est est-ce que le fait d'avoir été mariée avec un auteur, et en particulier un auteur de SF, a influencé sa manière d'écrire à elle, et si elle-même influençait son mari, puisqu'ils avaient finalement la même activité tous les deux.
Yes, Charles Sheffield, my late husband, died 10 years ago. And while we were married, we would read each other's manuscripts. And it was very useful, I think, to both of us. He was a scientist, a physicist, and he was much more interested in the science part of it than the characterization. We had a joke that he pronounced it science fiction, and I pronounced it science fiction. So I would critique his characters, and he would critique my science, and it was useful. Since his death, I have remarried Jack Skillingstead, who is also a science fiction writer, but not a scientist. And we do the same thing. We critique each other's manuscripts. And it is very useful. I know writers married to each other who never critique each other's manuscripts because they don't want to start domestic warfare. But I have found that it is very useful to get another professional point of view, someone who can say, not only does this not work, but you might try it this way. And another writer can do that. And I find that it's really useful. But again, it's not for everybody.
Voilà, si vous écrivez, mariez-vous avec d'autres gens qui écrivent. Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question? Est-ce qu'il y a une autre question dans la salle? Oui, monsieur.
Bonjour. Moi, je m'interroge en fait par rapport à votre processus de création. Je trouve ça intéressant la manière dont vous travaillez. Et vous dites en fait que les personnages ne sont pas l'auteur, c'est ce que vous avez dit au début de l'entretien. Et après, vous nous dites que vous êtes tombée amoureuse de certains de vos personnages masculins, etc. Et donc finalement, je me demandais si c'était pas une sorte de fantasme que vous mettiez dans vos histoires et finalement une part de vous-même, quoi.
Yes, of course it's a fantasy I'm acting out. When I'm writing, psychologists have what they call a flow state, where you are immersed in an activity so that the rest of the world seems to go away. And it doesn't have to be writing. You can be immersed in any work that is completely absorbing you so that you lose track of time, so that you become completely transported to another place. When I am writing, and I get into that flow state, the room around me fades away. I'm not in my study, sitting on my chair, typing on my computer. That's all gone. I'm in the world of my story, and that completely takes over. So yes, of course it's a fantasy, but in another way, it's a reality. It's a psychological reality of being lifted out of yourself. And I think it happens for many kinds of people doing many kinds of work. And it really is a good feeling. I will sometimes look up and think, oh, I've been writing for 20 minutes. And it turns out I've been writing for 3 hours. Because this world has faded away. And when I said that all writers are a little crazy, I was not being just flip or comical. Writers have this ability to dissociate from the reality around them, and so do madmen have that ability to dissociate from the writer, from the world around them. Studies show that writers suffer a larger degree of depression than normal people and a larger degree of dissociation, because we are all a little crazy. You have to be a little crazy to invest so much of yourself in worlds and people that don't exist. That makes all of you a little crazy as readers, too.
Et on a le temps encore pour une ou deux questions. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question à poser à Nancy Kress? Une fois, deux fois?
No?
Bon.
Well, then I'd like to thank you all for coming and for being such a good audience. Thank you.
Voilà, vous allez pouvoir la retrouver en dédicace cet après-midi. Et puis, la prochaine rencontre, on va parler des Chroniques martiennes de Ray Bradbury, une œuvre des origines. Merci à tous.